Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and I'm the host of the podcast titled Revolution Z. This is our 30th episode, and to celebrate having accomplished 30 episodes, we're going to do something different. This will be episode number one of a new sequence that will join the vision, strategy, and election sequences we have already been doing. This new sequence will try to verbally present a film I hope will be made. It's titled Next American Revolution, or as an abbreviation, NAR. I described some history and motivations for doing this last episode, and actually for writing the screenplay of Next American Revolution, just a couple of days ago in episode 29. The shorter version of that same story is that I wrote a book, I adapted it into a screenplay, and now, in what will likely be a dozen Revolution Z episodes, I will try to describe what the emergent movement, if it happens, will look like, words, visuals, and all. I'll do those episodes intermittently with the ones that I would have ordinarily done anyway. Will such a description be engaging, inspiring, useful? I don't know. Let's see. So to begin, imagine you are looking at a big movie screen, the room darkens, some music comes up. The accompaniment is maybe Bob Dylan's When the Ship Comes In, or Leonard Cohen's Democracy, or perhaps it is the Chambers Brothers' Time Has Come Today, or Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. Or maybe the director is more hip than me, and it is something equally brilliant, but more recent. Whatever the musical accompaniment may be, on the screen you see, reminiscent of the opening of Star Wars, a scrolling collage of photos of historic actors and events from both past and future. It runs for a bit, and then culminates in the main title and a text, which reads in bold large type, RPS, The Next American Revolution. And then continues, from a time barely beyond tomorrow, from a place barely bordering perception, reports of revolution resound. Massachusetts Senator Malcolm King and his running mate, California Governor Celia Curie, are in 2044 elected U.S. President and Vice President. As members of the organization Revolutionary Participatory Society, or RPS, they know that their inauguration is but a single intermediate step in 25 years of conceiving, organizing, demonstrating, striking, occupying, and creating. They are marching toward a new world made real. You next see the inside of the Oval Office of the U.S. President, with afternoon daylight entering from its windows. You also see Miguel Guevara, 39, a bit scruffy, in one chair. And you see newly elected President Malcolm King, 59, ex-Massachusetts Senator, exuding calm, and Vice President Celia Curie, 51, ex-California Governor, ex-actress, poised and exuberant, sitting opposite Guevara. Finally, pictures of various ex-presidents adorn the walls. You watch Miguel Guevara speak. Mr. President, he begins, and Celia Curie interrupts. Call him Malcolm. I do. We all do, she says. Guevara continues. But Madam Vice President, Curie responds. Miguel, please call me Celia. Guevara reluctantly continues. Well, okay. He turns to Malcolm and says, what a pleasure it must be to celebrate victory. How do you feel? Malcolm King answers. Eager. Cautious. Ideas won. Guevara interrupts. Yes, but you traversed the country. You campaigned. You won. Curie interjects. No, millions of volunteers and 100 million voters won. You next see the scene shift to a huge hall. It is clearly the site of an earlier nominating convention. You see Senator Malcolm King at the podium with Governor Celia Curie, and thousands of conventioneers all wildly celebrating their nomination. Then King speaks. 25 years ago, in 2019, someone running for president with my views was an impossible dream. Then Sanders brought hope, activism flourished, and here we are. The scene returns to the Oval Office interview. Guevara asks, Celia, what are your first reactions to the Oval Office? Curie points at the surrounding portraits, laughs, and answers, we need to redecorate. Guevara, smiling, adds, an immediate program? Curie replies, turning serious, hold a constitutional convention to revamp government. Enlarge the Supreme Court to reflect society. Build community housing, schools, and clinics. Drastically downsize the military. Deliver prison pardons. Renovate judicial procedures. King takes up the cadence and continues, Further innovate energy for ecological balance. Support workplace takeovers. Empower neighborhood assemblies. Pursue equitable economics to demolish income and wealth inequality. Institute more worker self-management. Initiate more participatory planning. Curie next adds, "We have waged a quarter-century journey of ceaseless struggle, but there is much more to come." Devera asks, "Do you feel pressure? Fear?" Curie answers soberly, "I feel tense and excited for the impact we can have." King adds, "Ignorant choices could impede change. I fear that." Curie elaborates, "Like the doctors do no harm or the ecologist precautionary principle, we have to do good but avoid damage." You now see a montage of scenes of early RPS on the screen. You see visuals of Trumpism versus anti-Trump hostilities, RPS organizers going door to door, Revolutionary Participatory Society holding a teach-in. And you hear Celia Curie's voice over the visuals. Curie says, "At RPS's beginning, friends, workmates, and relatives often feuded. Revolutionary Participatory Society members clash with their non-RPS neighbors. To advance, we had to overcome such differences. We had to raise consciousness." The visual montage continues, and you next see an RPS sit-in at an immigrant detention center, an RPS strike at a local workplace, and you hear Malcolm King's voice over the visuals. "As RPS grew, we sought change." You see an RPS community center, an RPS daycare program, and you hear King's voice continue. "We planted seeds of a better future. We won modest but escalating victories," while you see an occupied factory and hear King's voice say, "There were losses and setbacks, but mostly there was a steady march forward." And then you see the scene shift to New York's Times Square, where Juliet Berkman, 49, dressed jaunty, introduces Mayor Bill Hampton, wearing an RPS hat and looking elated. They address a massive crowd from a New Year's Eve-like stage, including a banner that reads, "RPS 2020-2044. You see Juliet Berkman say from the stage, "Inauguration Day, another step toward fulfilling our aims in every workplace, school, city, and state. I give you Mr. Mayor Bill Hampton." As applause slows, you see Bill Hampton reach out, sweep the audience, and say, "Politics used to be a competitive, elitist, money-grubbing, bureaucratic producer of hypocrisy. Now, politics is you." The scene you see then becomes a sky, a dreamscape visual of planes dropping parachutes dangling something beneath. And you hear Bill Hampton's voice over the striking visual. "As a child, I suffered nightmares of big planes silently, ominously, almost gently, dropping massive parachutes. Beneath each chute, swaying to a devil's dirge, huge cylindrical nuclear coffins drifted down to destroy all." We again see New York's Times Square. The crowd has gone silent. Bill Hampton smiles, points all around, and says, to growing shouts of support, "And I woke up. We all woke up. And now we all celebrate. And soon, very soon, we will all carry on." The scene shifts back to the Oval Office, and you see Guevara still interviewing King and Curie. And King answers a question that has obviously been put to him. "Inauguration Day approached. Rebels and rakes, outcasts, the gentle, the kind, poets and painters, bricklayers and truck drivers, saints and sinners, all sought a moment's celebration on the road to greater victories." Curie adds, "History had shackled society so long that many millions wanted to dance in the streets." King continues, "To accommodate, we held events in hundreds of counties. We danced to decades of struggle. We danced preparatory to battling on." The scene next shifts to New York's Central Park, midday. You see Miguel Guevara walking with Juliet Berkman, a sedate and confident union organizer. It is August 4th, 2042. You realize seeing this that the movie is going to continue to flash forward and back repeatedly to tell the story of the oncoming Revolutionary Participatory Society. And Miguel Guevara adds, "Juliet, do you remember first becoming radical?" Juliet Berkman answers, "In 2016, horrified at Trump's election, I drank myself sick. What had happened? It seemed like hell made real. Earth would burn, but friends roused me." You then see Guevara ask, "But why become radical? Why not pursue conventional success?" And Berkman answers, I feared fascism, but I despised conventional success. To me, dinner parties, stretch limos, and mansions were morally repulsive. I preferred love and dignity to money and power. Guevara smiles and says, I became a dissident rather than a mainstream journalist with approximately the same feelings. But I wonder, what were some key RPS events for you? Berkman answers, the first two RPS conventions woke me. The campaign for balanced jobs in 2024 inspired me. The campaign for the 30-hour work week in 2025 steeled me. But even earlier, I particularly remember a meeting arranged with workers at a defense plant connected with a university where students were opposing military research. I spoke to an assembly of protesting students and defense-involved employees. The scene shifts, and you see an assembly hall where the audience includes workers and student protesters. You watch the young Juliet Berkman, 25, dressed for street battle, speak as workers heckle and students cheer. Young Juliet Berkman virtually screams from the stage, war kills, stop weapons, stop killing, shut down. An angry worker from the audience screams back, you steal our livelihoods, you ignore our needs. And the scene suddenly shifts back to Central Park, where the Berkman-Guevara interview continues. Walking with Guevara, Juliet Berkman offers, they were right, I had much to learn, it wasn't easy. Guevara asks, was there a second personal event? The scene shifts again, and you see the interior of an ornate church hosting a respectful memorial service. You hear Berkman's voice over the church visual. At a memorial service for 60 civil rights activists, the music and solidarity transported me until I saw in my head activists decades earlier risking life and limb in Birmingham. The scene shifts to 1963 Birmingham, where you see activists at a Birmingham rally. It is historic footage that shows Martin Luther King Jr. speaking to the assembled protesters. I have heard numerous Southern religious leaders admonish their worshippers to comply with the desegregation decision because it is the law, but I have longed to hear white ministers declare, follow this decree because integration is morally right and because the Negro is your brother. And you hear Berkman's voiceover then say, but I had my first truly RPS moment at a Detroit rally. And you see a Detroit street where a lively crowd listens to a Detroit speaker on a makeshift stage militantly urge, raise wages, end police violence, wage peace, win the world. And the scene returns to Central Park, where you again see Berkman and Guevara, who now walk past some adults playing soccer. Berkman asks, so Miguel, what got you into journalism? Guevara looks at the soccer players and says, I was in college, headed, I thought, for a soccer future, Olympics and all. But the competitiveness and macho behaviors of coaches and players alike drove me away from soccer. Then the eye-opening revelations of those times and the readings I followed up with took me into activism. But back to you. Many pinpoint the 2021 march of 500,000 protesters on Wall Street as their RPS start. Were you there? Berkman answers, yes, and as nervous as I was, I even gave a speech. The scene changes and you see Wall Street. You watch young Juliet exhort a huge cheering crowd. We seek dignity and justice, she says. We won't settle for the periphery of power. We do not oppose impoverished budgets, escalating inequity, resurgent racism, sexual predation, assembly line schools, corporate profiteering, divisive classism, Inus war, hideous repression, or planetary climate catastrophe. No, we oppose them all. We don't demand racial solidarity, cultural integrity, gender equity, sexual diversity, political freedom, collective self-management, or economic equity, classlessness, and ecological sanity. No, we demand it all. We don't want old bosses, nor do we want new ones. The scene shifts again to return to Central Park, where Guevara and Berkman now sit on a bench near a pond with ducks. Juliet Berkman says, if you told me in 2019 that 25 years later we would witness society fundamentally transforming, I would have laughed. 50 years maybe, 25 no way. But it turned out that people only needed hope. Guevara responds, anger roused me, but you are right, hope gave me direction. You focused on workers' lives, What were early turning points in battling economic injustice? Berkman answers, the Amazonia strike was one. We had all bought from Amazonia just by clicking links, but then suddenly 300,000 Amazonia workers sat down and became visible. They sat down to stand tall. The scene shifts to an Amazonia assembly plant where you see an Amazonia worker mechanically doing her task. Then the camera pans to more and more similar workers, and then to plant after plant, and then to workers sitting in the plant, occupying it, on strike. And the scene becomes an Amazonia warehouse where you can see that workers have occupied the place. You watch an Amazonia strike leader speak through a bullhorn from a doorway. At the same time, supporters surround the plant and speak from their own makeshift stage. And families and friends bring food, and students bring supplies and buffer against police intervention, and the police approach. And you watch the Amazonia strike leader address the police for all to hear. We are Amazonia's workers. We will not move. Scabs will not replace us. Invade our warehouse, we will dismantle it. Enter, we will wreak havoc. And the young Juliet Berkman from the makeshift supporter stage says, also to the police, but for all to hear, do as you will, but like the workers inside, we will remain. We are students, lawyers, mail carriers. We are cooks, farmers, assemblers. We are doctors and off-duty cops. Amazonia has our hearts. You watch the Amazonia strike leader continue. Reject our demands, we will maintain our occupation. Issue court orders, we will scoff. Serve injunctions, we will laugh. Arrest us, we will clog your jails. Smash us, we will replenish. We will persist. And then you see her look at rows of police and say, officers, we know it is your job to follow orders, but you too want shorter hours and better wages. You too want a better world for your kids. Bludgeon us if you must. We will talk with you. And then on the screen, you see some police and workers converse. The scene shifts back to Central Park, where the Guevara Berkman interview continues. And walking along, Berkman says, talking diminished police anger, not completely, but some. And after a week, American Package and United Express workers stopped delivering. And then, bam, new work hours, new payment schemes. But you know, the speed arguably obscured the difficulty. The workers and their supporters, too, had to overcome old habits and fears to take the stand we did. The night before I went to the Amazonia plant, I was petrified and couldn't sleep. Some slid easily into dissent. They were courageous or so aroused that they were oblivious to the risk. Not me. I was really afraid. Guevara goes on. Can you recall another turning point for you? And Berkman replies, yes, a second turning point was a campaign to raise Harvard's kitchen and custodial workers' wages. Activists sought improved work conditions and higher wages, but also envisioned optimal conditions and incomes for the future. The scene shifts, and you see Harvard Medical School where students rally with signs. Many wear medical garb. You watch a student demonstrator plaintively ask assembled protesters, why do those who clean classrooms earn less than those who lecture students? Do they work less hard? Is the cleaning they do less onerous? Do they work fewer hours? You next hear Berkman's voice over the visuals. She says, after dozens of dorm and classroom discussions, teach-ins, work stoppages, and administration threats, a group of medical students rejected admission policies, training methods, and even the culture of the profession they planned to enter. Their dissent spread, and soon we had embattled movements of doctors, lawyers, economists, engineers, accountants, and architects for the people. I hope it is okay that I think this is perhaps a place to take a break before continuing with Next American Revolution in the second NAR episode in a few days. But is it okay? Is this experiment, verbally presenting a film that is only hoped for and not yet really there to see, sensible? I remember decades ago there was a comedian, Steve Allen was his name, who read lyrics of pop songs as poems to raucous laughter. Bebopalula, I remember, was one that he read. His reading is probably on YouTube. It really is funny. The point is, reading the lyrics didn't exactly capture the actual musical intent. More like reading the lyrics demolished the intent. Of course, that song, and probably most others that Steve Allen picked, weren't Leonard Cohen or Bob Dylan-level lyrics. Instead, even as music, and certainly as standalone writing, they left a whole lot to be desired. So I wonder, have I done Next American Revolution's 10% or so a service, or have I demolished it with this verbal description? And for that matter, is the screenplay itself, or rather the film that could be built from it, mostly vapid like the song Bebopalula, or at least a little wise like Leonard Cohen's song Democracy, or Bob Dylan's song When the Ship Comes In? Either way, this is Michael Albert, signing off for now for the podcast Revolution Z.